let's start with just brief introductions so we can all know who everybody is. I'm Paula Martin, Vice Chair. Lydia's not here, so I'll take it over today.
My name is Nichols. I'm on the Battleground School Board. So I represent Craig Park and Zoning.
Tyskover, Vancouver City Council. Living downtown. So represent that part.
Rebecca Royce, Clark County Staff.
Bridget McClayman, Community District 2, maybe?
The west side. North side.
West and north.
Michael Torres, Clark County Staff.
Janet Smith, Clark County Staff.
Julie Rotz, Camas School Board. And I'm Judith Walseth, and I'm hopefully today the newest board member, but I represent the East County area.
Okay.
And I'm really pretty close to Evergreen High School where I live, so it's on pretty far, this far east.
And I'm Kate Adam with Clark County.
Sherry Karen, Lone Camera. We have some visitors.
My name is RJ Stanglin. I'm the Program Housing Manager for Impact Northwest.
Awesome.
I'm Jamie Falco. I'm the Clark County Housing
Green, guys. So we need to approve the January minutes. Everybody got a copy of those? I'm assuming you reviewed them before we got there. So the motion to approve?
I will move to approve the January minutes.
Thank you, Ty. Got a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passed. And now we have... Now we're finally going to vote on updating the bylaws, but Rebecca's going to discuss the changes quickly.
So we went over a lot of the changes at the January meeting, and we got a lot of feedback about additional changes that we could make. We sent out the bylaws almost 2 weeks ago for review to see if there was any other changes. Ty brought back a couple of cleanup items that were really great to incorporate in. So I thought I would go over the newest changes so we have them on record and show the changes that Ty had recommended. In the page one, article one name, we had missed the word and after the comma of counselors. And so I appreciate Ty finding that. And if we go to page four, under article four members, section one composition, in section two, we added in some more clarification as recommended by Karen Dunn, our commerce staff, to put a little bit more information under the section two, and that way it just says how a low-income representative is nominated to the board. And then also on section three, Ty had noticed that we had duplicated the last sentence where it says, to the extent possible, at least one shall reside in each advisory board. It's actually mentioned again under section two, selection and appointment. So we are recommending that we just delete that line that we had added in. And section four, the new section four, we've had quite a bit of discussion in the executive team on how exactly to meet the new organizational standards on underrepresented groups wanting to petition the board. So the final language is kind of what we boiled everything down to, and it basically states that if a person or group feels like they are being underrepresented on the board, they can petition the board through staff. Staff will bring it to the board for review, and then we will let that person or group know what the outcome of the board is after discussion. And so we kind of made it pretty succinct as far as what we'll be doing if a group feels like they're underrepresented. That is on page four, and it's section one.
Okay.
Then under section two, selection and appointment, at the January retreat, it was recommended that we beef up and really put in what the process is for when a board member is going through the application process. So we added in that staff will facilitate an advisory board of review of all applicants, and that once the advisory board's review recommendation has been made, it goes to the county manager through to the county counselors for final approval. So we just kind of, that's been the process, but we just want to make sure that it was captured in the bylaws. Under section two, low-income representative, at the January retreat, we talked about adding in the specific language from the information memorandum number 82 regarding tripartite boards and the low-income representatives. So we have that official language added to the bylaws. And then under two, section, or low-income representatives, section C. This was added in as part of our conversation with Karen at the January retreat regarding low-income representatives being able to be reimbursed for costs of attending the meeting. So travel or child care, we can go ahead and reimburse those costs, and we can facilitate that through the county. Same selection and appointment section number three, we realized we did not have the sentence, to the extent possible, at least one shall reside in each advisory board district. So we wanted to make sure that it was noted in each of the member types, elected officials, community representatives, and low-income representatives. And then we have the informational binder orientation, and just a little bit of cleanup there, showing that it's an informational binder and that there is a question and answer period. Are there any questions about that so far? I know I'm going kind of fast. Okay, great. So under section three, period of service, to meet the org standards, we added in an individual nominated by a low-income organization to serve as a representative shall serve only while they continue to be associated with the organization that nominated that individual. And that's part of the org standards, and we had missed it in the bylaws, so we wanted to make sure we brought that up to what the standard is.
I think Rebecca will just pick just a typo.
There's a typo?
Yeah, since you got rid of she, they, get rid of the S on continuous.
Oh, it is there. It's crossed off, and okay. You just can't see it, but thank you. It's hard to see with the track changes.
In my eyesight, so.
And then if we skip all the way up to page 9, there's no other actual changes until page 9, Article 7 under meetings. Anne at the retreat had brought up that, at a retreat you're not supposed to be doing business. We wanted to make sure that we could do business at our annual retreat because that's a majority of what that meeting involves is business that we need to take care of for the org standards. So we decided to change it from annual retreat to annual meeting and noted that this is to be considered a regular meeting for conducting business. That way we don't... or we make sure that we can get everything accomplished that we need to at the annual retreat. And as Karen Dunn at Commerce had recommended to be a little bit more vague in our regular scheduled meetings instead of stating exactly what day and time we're going to meet, we will have that as part of our annual meeting to set the agenda for the year. So it'll be a brief discussion about that. So we made that a little bit more vague. Down on the bottom of page 9, under public access and notification, we added in that notification of meetings will be added to our Community Action website, which they have always been. We just didn't have it in the bylaws. And that we have, if anybody is interested in receiving notification about the advisory board, that they can, they just need to let us know as staff, and we'll add them to that list so any public member can be at the meeting and be advised of the meeting and what the agenda contents are. Since we've had a lot of interest in the advisory board through the application processes over the last several months, we thought it might be a good idea to add in a little bit of structure to the meetings for our public, for the public coming into the meeting. So we added in section 3 that says members of the public are welcome to attend the regularly scheduled meetings as guests. And guests will have the opportunity to briefly address the advisory board during open forum at the end of the meeting. So you'll see on our agenda, we actually have added that. And that if they would like to actually present information to the board, that they can do that. They just need to contact staff and let us know so that we can actually get them on the agenda. And then under section 8 on page 10, there was discussion that we wanted to make it a little bit easier for board members that wouldn't be able to attend to be able to vote on different aspects of the meeting business that was going on. And so we went ahead and added in that they can, that advisory board members can vote by email or in person. If you do it by email, you need to send it to staff before the meeting so that we have it, and then it will be read at the staff, so it's made a part of the minutes. And if you go to, the last couple of changes are on page 11. Under executive committee, the executive committee had basically been doing this where we would have discussions about different topics with the executive team, and then we would come back to the advisory board to ratify those decisions. However, we didn't state it in the bylaws, so we now make sure that we say that those decisions will be ratified at the next regularly scheduled meeting. And the very last line of page 11 we felt was redundant information, which just really wasn't needed regarding advisory other committees, and that committee members can, if we have a standing committee, it can go as long as the committee is there. They don't have to be elected each year. However, we're very cognizant of our committees, and we try to make sure that they are, there's a specific timeline for those committees, not necessarily just 1 year, but an actual timeline. So I know there's a lot of changes to the bylaws that we've been talking about over the last few meetings. Is there anything?
Yeah, I didn't plan to do it more. I apologize for not emailing this in section 2, selection and appointment.
Article 4, page 4?
Yeah. It says for appointment by the county councils. They are actually appointed by the county manager, and the councils accept his recommendation. So they do not appoint.
Okay.
You could have it read recommendations of the county manager for appointment period. Members shall assume office after having been accepted by the councilors. I mean, technically it doesn't make much difference, but it's consistent with the charter.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else?
No further discussion? Are you prepared to vote and move a motion to accept the changes to the bylaws as Rebecca presented them and just recently changed?
I so moved.
Second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion's carried. Nice job, Rebecca. Thank you. Getting us all legal and stuff.
Fun work standards, trying to get us in line.
All right, now we have task force updates. And Jessica's going to do advocacy efforts.
So,
or actually, Kate's going to do that.
That's right. So, as you are all aware, at the retreat, there was an ask for CAB members to join an advocacy task force. The reason for that task force is the Washington State Community Action Partnership has very much been encouraging community action boards to be heavily involved in advocacy efforts at all levels. And staff had tried a number of different avenues to encourage advocacy and still felt like there was more that could be done, and wanted to utilize the expertise of the CAB in defining how to move forward and engage Community Action Advisory Board members more heavily in advocacy. So thanks to Jesse Ghilieri, Lydia Sanders, Paula Martin, Cherie Toon, for being a part of that advocacy task force. We met earlier in February and had our inaugural meeting. The members who were there decided to appoint Jesse as chair, and ordinarily she would be giving this update, but she's just not available to be here today, so I said I would fill in. Our meeting was really focused around how we can create an infrastructure for the Community Action Advisory members that would help them be successful around advocacy. The first conversation was around involvement and whether or not there could be outside people involved with the advocacy task force. Those who were there felt like they wanted to invite those who had previously applied for the CAB to be a part of the advocacy task force, as well as Adam Kravitz from an agency called Outsiders Inn, which focuses on engaging people without homes in the community to share what their experiences are like and advocating on their behalf. And so, you know, learning from Adam and understanding what the needs really are of people who are on the street, as well as just increasing the expertise and the number of people within the task force from people who were initially interested in the CAB. And so I'm going to be reaching out to those folks to see if they're interested in engaging in the task force. The next thing that the group had identified as a need is what exactly is advocacy? You know, it's a buzz term, but what does that mean for the Community Action Advisory Board members? And what is it that we're asking board members to track? And so the task force had asked staff to identify, you know, what are things that can be done that qualifies as advocacy. A few of those ideas were talking to politicians, volunteering with people who are low income or without homes, supporting or assisting someone who's low income, attending meetings related to the population that is served through the CAB, as well as just having conversations with people. And so as you can see, it's a very broad definition, and the task force really thought that there was much advocacy going on, but the board members didn't recognize that that could be reported on as advocacy. And so staff will create a document that helps to provide information as to what counts as advocacy. The other idea was to create an online tool for CAB members to be able to report on their advocacy. We have a very intricate spreadsheet that the Washington State Community Action Partnership has asked us to fill in. And it involves how many times did board members reach out to elected officials? How did they reach out? Was there any response? And so in order to capture that detailed information, the advocacy task force thought that a Google document might be a good start so that board members can easily just, you know, pull it up, report, and then submit it to staff so that we can keep track of it. Staff will be creating that and then piloting it in the future. Also, an idea around creating an FAQ, still around that idea of what is advocacy, providing a definition, as well as just commonly asked questions. You know, when I'm advocating, can I represent the Community Action Advisory Board? Can I say I'm on the Community Action Advisory Board? Can I say I'm representing the Board of County Councilors? All really good questions that we want to be able to provide answers to so that the board members can go out understanding what their role is and, you know, what is appropriate, what isn't appropriate. And so as far as next steps, staff has many documents that they're working on and will be creating to present at the next task force meeting in about a week and a half. They're also going to be inviting additional individuals that have been identified to the task force, working with Jesse as the chair to create the agenda, and then moving forward just to help the CAB members increase the advocacy that they're doing in the community. Any questions or ideas that you might have that we can pass along to the task force? Any task force members that wanted to add anything?
Thank you.
Awesome.
Okay. Thanks, Kate. Thank you. Community needs assessment, Rebecca?
So this one's brief. I want to thank Paula, Lydia, and Bridget for being volunteering for the community needs assessment task force. If anyone else is interested in being on that task force, you know, we're always taking on new volunteers. We have yet to meet. Our first meeting will be on Monday, March 21st, and we'll kind of go over what the previous community needs assessment looked like, the process, the timeline, and it's just some basic information that the task force will be working on. We'll elect a chair and then move forward from there.
Awesome. Okay. Impact Northwest.
All right.
You guys are up.
On the screen, on the keyboard, the W. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, thank you. All right. I don't do many PowerPoint slides, so this is all education. So my name is RJ Stanglet. I'm the housing manager for Impact Northwest. This is Jamie, the housing lead specialist. Just to kind of give you a brief overview of what we do, we have some fundamentals. With the change of, I guess, less resources in our community, we've really had to focus what's the most important target population. Through our partnerships and some of the work groups that we're a part of, We've determined that chronically and literally homeless individuals and families are the priority right now with the limited resources that we have. The majority of the households that we work with are low income, which means under 30% area median income. Our service model is standard regardless of what programming we do. We do a strength-based, person-centered case management approach, progressive engagement, meaning we're meeting them where they're at, and then during our case management work, we're continually elevating them until they reach self-sufficiency when they can exit. And we're trying to minimize the amount of resources that we need to use per family so we can help the most families as possible. We're also a trauma-informed care agency, meaning that we believe everyone experiencing homelessness or any part of life has experienced trauma. And if we don't recognize that, then we may re-traumatize them in our case management model. So in our individualized approach, we're always sensitive to reactions and how we frame things when we're talking about homelessness and trying to rehouse someone. We are experts at landlord advocacy and coordination. We've learned a lot through our permanent supportive housing programs up here, which have dealt with master leasing, which is a whole new kind of negotiation with an apartment manager and an owner. Previously, we had a focus on rent assistance, which meant that the client pretty much fit all screening criteria for the apartment, and then we would just do rent assistance and case management apart from them paying the landlord directly. Now, with our learning from last year, we negotiate that we will rent the entire apartment for a year, and then we will bring clients that can fit in, but we guarantee rent, so the landlord trusts that we can work with someone who, on paper, looks very non-traditional from who really screens at their apartments, but they have the confidence that because it's really an Impact Northwest name, that they know that any damages will be our liability. We know that we will pay rent on time. And then if there are any little hiccups that could have happened, we have a response time immediately. Talk to the landlord, talk to the client. And then once someone actually exits our program, we still do retention and follow-ups to find out how are you doing in 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months. At any point in time, an old client can call us and we can always give resources to them. So some of the work that we do can only be done through partnership in our community. The lead right now is the Council for the Homeless and the Housing Solutions Center, because we have agreed that a coordinated entry approach is the most equitable, that one place is determining who is the most vulnerable in our community. Partners in Careers has graciously given us office space up here, and then they also have other resources that we are not experts in, primarily the employment side. We're part of the coordinated assessment group, which is determining what is the target population, what are the criteria that we want to focus on. We're now part of the Ending Family Homelessness Collaborative with the Housing First model. We're part of the Housing First work group on how to implement Housing First up, and also the Coalition of Service Providers. And lastly, I just put this down here, is that in any kind of year, we're always looking for additional resources. And we were fortunate enough, the executive director, Susan Stoltenberg, and myself, presented to the Community Foundation of Southwest Washington and applied for a $20,000 grant, because we knew that there was always going to be gaps that could be filled through other resources. And they funded us this fiscal year. And we intend to use that funding to support our programming this coming year. Again, these are the programs that, or some of these programs you guys have awarded us, and we want to thank you for giving us the confidence in doing so. The first one is a rapid rehousing program focused primarily on households that are receiving TANF. We will serve 5 households this year. The next one is an emergency solutions grant where it is a literally homeless household, and we will serve 2 this year. And the last one is the supportive services for veteran families, which we've had up here for, I think this is the 3rd year now, and we're currently serving 30 households. We also are part now of the Permanent Supporting Housing Program. I broke this down as 2 because they come from 2 different sources, and I really want to commend you guys for supporting us, because without the Permanent Supportive Housing local money, we would not be able to do the HUD because we did not have the match. So in total, we will serve 13. We could, depending on whatever the rents we can find in either program, master leasing or rent assistance, we may be able to do more than that. But from right now, we've served 10 in the federal permanent supportive housing, We have two currently enrolled in our local, and we have one more that we are going to get from the Council for the Homeless, who they deem as being the most vulnerable in our continuum. The high VAT score is how they're assessing. That may migrate into the SPDAT, which is another assessment tool to figure out who's the most vulnerable. Our contract right now still says VAT, so we're going to go with that until changes happen. So what are our program outcomes? These are standard in any programming we do, because we find that if we can increase income in a household, that has a higher probability that they're going to be able to afford wherever their housing is. If they have fixed income, then we're working on a housing plan that involves, what is your portion of income going to rent? Is that a shared room experience? Is that a studio apartment? Is it an SRO? If it's not fixed or whatnot, then our next one is, you're an able body. What are your employment goals? What do you want to do after you're done to have the income to come to pay rent, pay your utility bills, have enough income to support your children and their goals? We engage everybody with health services. Anyone that comes into our programming, we automatically ask, part of our standard intake is to find out, do you have health insurance? Do you need healthcare services? If not, that's one of our focuses, to make sure that they have that before anything else, because connecting to resources can take time. Apart from that, we're then looking for the housing search. What are your barriers? If there are barriers that we can address through negotiation, we do that. If there, we have resources to minimize a barrier, we'll do that. And then we're teaching them or walking with them on how to present themselves to a landlord. We go with them to advocate with the landlord, so we're stepping back. We're hoping that they can frame whatever barriers that may look bad on paper, that they can explain it themselves. If they're not comfortable with that, then we're right there to guide them with it about what this program can do, what it can't do, and then the landlord either makes a decision, yes, I'll work with you, or I won't. Some of our outcomes that kind of predict whether or not our programming is successful is whether they're still housed when they exit, whether they're still housed at 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months. I put this as an average because some of our programming varies, but as a general average among what we're looking for, we want to go from 90 to 100% that they're housed before they exit. It's very rare that we'd exit someone who would be homeless still. It only rarely happens when there is unable to contact for many months, going through every contact point. 3 months, 90%, more than likely, that's always going to hit. 6 months, 80, 12 months, 70. We've never gone close to 70 at 12 months. We're more in like the low 80s, mid 80s range.
So then these are your goals or these are your actuals? I'm confused.
No, these are our goals. Okay. Our actuals vary every fiscal year or programming year. When we do our quarterly reports, we put the actual numbers in there. And then we have a couple success stories from our permanent supportive housing, and Jannie, as the lead housing specialist, can give you a couple examples of how we've worked.
Peter was the first person that we actually housed in the PSH program, and we actually learned a lot working with him. The first place that we were able to master lease seemed like a really good idea, an elevator, it was a gated community, things like that, but what we have learned working with this population is that when the chronically homeless become housed, they want to help all of their friends. This was definitely a learning curve. In the beginning, we had a lot of notices because he would have people staying over, he'd have people, you know, asking people to let them in because they didn't have keys. That was something that we were lucky enough to have a very patient landlord that worked with us on it, and he eventually was successful and didn't have any more notices. He had the main goal of dying on his own terms, basically. He had mental health challenges, he had a terminal illness, physical disabilities, and he did not want to die in hospice or the hospital. He was successfully housed for 10 months. He passed away in December. And we were able to maintain that relationship with the landlord after the turnover. And it started out really rough, and it ended up being a really successful lease. And then Lindsay was the third person that we housed. And she, when we met her, she was living in a very small car in a parking lot with her two dogs that were very elderly. And she has a lot of fears and triggers related to people in general. We got her into an apartment that was on the ground floor, and as much as we worked with her, that was not working out for her because she was very fearful that people could get in through the window that was on the ground floor. Because of the flexibility in this program, and we had already master leased other apartments, we were actually able to transition her into a second story apartment. And since then, she's been a lot more successful. She has actually gotten her SSDI, has gone through on her third appeal, and she is doing very well now. Doesn't have a lot of the same triggers going on. She's able to interact with the community a lot more because she does feel like she has a safe place to retreat to.
And the other thing, building the relationships with these landlords, we get calls now from our master leasing landlords asking, hey, do you have another apartment? Do you have another person? And it's taken us a year to develop that. Our first year was slow, but we are now at the point where we have more apartments being offered to us than clients than we can house, which I think is a great thing. I'd rather err on that side than when we struggled last year when rents were going out of control. Landlords didn't know what this program meant, and through the three or the four different landlords that we're working with, all of them would give us a recommendation as an agency to work as a master lease program. So now it's your time to grill us if you have any questions or if I skip something.
So I want to understand where you fit in this continuum.
Okay.
Yeah.
So our primary role is the housing piece. So when we have a referral from...
So we have housing first.
Yep.
Okay, so that's where you... like. So there's housing first, but then you said you're getting high needs clients from Council of Homeless. So, the 30 most high needs are targeted towards Lincoln Place. Where do you fall in?
So we are still housing first as well, but we don't have the 24-hour approach that Lincoln Place has. So we still, when we are part of that coordinated assessment, we are, when we ask for a referral, the Council for the Homeless is doing an assessment, and they give the most vulnerable. Lincoln Place definitely is getting the highest scores on the VAT and SPADAT because they do have the 24-hour on-site approach. Ours is a scattered site housing first model, though we do have the ability to do a rapid response. And a lot, and the half the reason that, or I'd say the primary reason that we're successful is that landlords contact us immediately before contacting a client because they realize that they give a notice right away that could almost exacerbate whatever kind of behavior is happening. So normally we're contacted, we go to see, investigate what is the complaint, talk about it, report back to the landlord, and a lot of times we minimize any kind of notices on their behalf and they remain housed.
And so that's for your permanent supported housing program.
Yes.
And then you have others. How about the TANF program?
So the TANF, we would still do, again, because we're a coordinated entry point, when we have openings, we have five, we'll get the same referrals from the Council for the Homeless. They will prioritize the most vulnerable that meet that eligibility. One of the eligibility criteria, though, is that it's a household that has currently TANF and is homeless. We would still do the housing first model, so if there are other barriers, we would try to overcome those barriers, get them housed, and address whatever issues that may be present afterwards. It's always a housing placement, and then working towards whatever goals that they have.
I don't know what TANF is.
Temporary.
And in general, I'm hoping you don't use all these acronyms with your clients. Please, dear God, so you don't, because I'm struggling.
So I apologize. I've done this work for 7 years, and yeah, it's almost, when I took over the Veteran Affairs Veteran Housing Program, it's all acronyms. I was in the same boat. So I'd have to go, what does that mean? So TANF is an income source for temporary assistance for needy families. So it just means that they are on welfare as their primary income. The goal is to get them housed, use their limited income as a portion of their rent, and then get them off TANF or their welfare income so that they would have other income sources to pay full rent in a quick manner.
So you mentioned SSI appeals.
Mm-hmm.
Do you sort of process the support client in appealing through the process, or do you hand it off to another partner who does that sort of thing?
I'm a SOAR, which is a process to get SSI or SSDI. This particular case, prior to coming to us, she had already had a couple of appeals and had an attorney, so we were not able to assist her with that. But we were able to support her in gathering the documents that the attorney was having difficulty getting her to participate with him, and she was able to do a successful appeal.
So it's one of those things that CAB, for example, could look at. There used to be a really high differential rate in the success of appeals in between Clark County and Cowlitz County, and Clark got screwed in that process, a lot of clients. So is this sort of data that would be, it's a sort of system piece that would be interesting for CAB to look at?
And I'll just throw out there regarding the SOAR program. That stands for SSI, SSDI, Outreach, Access, and Recovery. And it's a best practice evidence-based model that is funded by a federal agency. And it's a very clear and prescriptive model that people are trained in a two-day process. And then they are credentialed to be able to support people in attaining their Social Security. And so the CAB funds a SOAR program through Community Services Northwest with one coordinator. And then they work with all the different housing agencies and a few others to train the staff so that they can work with their clients to obtain Social Security if appropriate.
I apologize again for the acronyms for our programming name. That just makes it simple to talk about. It's just different funding sources, and that's why I use the acronym. We never tell a client that you're in the CHG TANF program. You're in a housing program. Yes?
So a question I have, and I have no problem with you coming back later with an answer for this one. I thought it was interesting with your goals that they start out high in the trajectory, over time lowers. And I'd be interested in wanting to know a little bit more about the why behind over time, you know, why it drops to 80 and then 70%. I would expect that you would want it to ratchet up a little bit.
I can kind of answer that. And a related question to that would be what is program exit? You know, like when is that mark? But basically, that whole contingent of people, the 90, 80, mm-hmm. 70, those are people that have already exited the program. And so you're not adding people to it or the intervention is changing. The intervention has happened. They've achieved this plateau of stability, and it's just tracking them. You know, it's the aftermath. It's the quality assurance of, so where are you at now? Where are you at 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, you know? So in that continuum, you know, you will have some people that are no longer housed. It could be they passed away. It could be they moved out of the area and you've lost contact with them. They may or may not be housed, but you don't know that.
The unknown is a big part of what that 12-month warning is, why it's lower.
Okay.
Like I said, though, when we run the numbers and when we do our quarterly reports, it normally tends to be around 6 months we have mid-80s, and then at 12 months it's around the same, 80, 82.
Okay.
We do 70 because we never know about the contact part, or yes, moving out of service area,
sure. So, and what those really represent, you know, are I don't want to say minimum service levels, that'd be the wrong word, but those are their performance benchmarks, their low, you know, like the standards that you've set up for yourself is, and we want to do no worse, you know, or better than 80%,
mm-hmm.
you know, 70% of 12 months or whatever.
Yeah. And to hit on your question about when we exit a client, it's really a conversation with the client. Yes, some programming has maximum timelines
mm-hmm.
of how much case management we can do. But normally, we're talking with them, we're budgeting with them monthly, we're encouraging employment or income increasing goals, so that when the budget's there, where it's reasonable that 30 to 50% of their income is their rent, and they have enough to cover the rest of their expenses, we're having the conversation of, what does it look like with me not doing monthly or weekly contact with you, monthly home visit? And then we'll do a test. Normally the final 30 days is when they know that, okay, at the end of this month is your exit date. What does that look like? They're paying full rent. We're checking in with them. If they are all on board and they're fully employed and paying rent, then we're like, okay, we'll check back with you in 3 months, but you have my number, so if there's a crisis, give me a call.
Thank you.
Termination and program exit is talked about the entire time that they're in the program. From the beginning, this is what an average service time looks like. This is what happens throughout the program, and when you get to this place, this is when, you know, the training wheels come off. And I have clients that have been exited for 2 years that'll still email me and be like, hey, I need diapers. Where can I go for diapers? And I'll just send them resources, or they'll call me. I have lots of clients that'll call and update me and be like, you haven't called me for a while. I just wanted to do a follow-up. Or my cell phone number changed, or I moved to Tacoma. This is my address. Can you send me this?
The other thing, especially with funding limits, we're also very upfront, depending when someone comes into our programming, what this program can do, also barring whatever funding constraints that we have. If we know we're coming down to a new fiscal year, we're saying, hey, look, this is the timeline that we're confident that we have. So why don't we plan that at this point in time, you will be ready. If you're not, then we're going to find something else for you in the next fiscal year. But this is the timeline that we have and we can dedicate to you.
So you mentioned managed leases, I think it was.
Master leasing.
Master leasing.
Yes.
So those people who are in the program and get housing and a master lease and are moving towards exit, does that mean they retain that managed lease apartment?
So the master lease is that we need to start the program with a 1-year master lease in Impact Northwest name. If at the time they are exiting the program, we would transfer the lease into their name, and then they would be paying full rent to the landlord directly, and then we would look for a new apartment to master lease.
Just a couple of questions. Do you ever have them, you have follow-ups on, do they ever re-enter?
In our veteran program, we did have some people re-enter. It was mostly from a preventive piece that the program had very limited resources in the veteran housing side for prevention. So when we reached the maximum of that, we exited them from that funding source, continued to case manage, minimize them moving out, and then when they entered the shelter system, the VA then deemed them eligible to be in the homeless part of the veteran program. So in that case, they did re-enter. From the rapid rehousing side, meaning they were homeless, came into our programming, our 12-month follow-ups, I would say a couple households, maybe in the last 2 years, have re-entered the system, but not into our programming due to limitations.
And then my second question is, where all are you? Where are the apartments you find? Are they all centered here in Vancouver? Do they reach out further?
Our master leasing program is primarily focused in Vancouver because we found that the fair market rents were easier to work with that limitation, and we've had strong landlord participation. We're always looking, we looked in Washougal, we looked in Camas, we looked in Battleground. We're also trying to be cognizant of where the participant wants to live. And really, transportation has been one of the primary focuses of where they want to be, especially if you need to go to the VA for the hospital. They want to be as close to whichever bus line that can get them in within an hour. In some of our veteran housing programs, we have gone through the entire county.
Almost a world, actually.
Yes.
What percentage of your clients have children, as opposed to, young children? And what challenges have you had with families rather than individuals?
So when we moved from a preventive piece from last fiscal year, which was also funded by the CAP, through the CHG grant, it was all family. I think we served 22 households in the prevention side. As we move into this new contract year, the TANF one will be 5 households with children. The 2 for the rapid rehousing that are literally homeless can be individuals or families. We don't decide who's supplied or not referred to us. In the veteran side, we found that primarily they're single, chronically homeless people. And as a standard, when someone's chronically homeless, they tend to be singles. It's very rare that it's a chronically homeless family. As for challenges working with families with children, I'll let Jenny give some insight on our prevention side, what we did last year with households.
I'd say that the biggest challenge is clients that have a lot of commitments, whether they are having to participate in a work program because they are receiving TANF, and being placed at jobs, and then trying to figure out, you know, the daycare and the job program and the job and doing all of it on a public bus lane. Because a lot of these people will be up from 5 riding the bus until 8 to drop their children off at daycare so that they can be to work by 10, and then starting all over at 4 to spend 3 hours on the bus to get their kids and go home. That causes a lot of frustration on the parents' part, just because they don't feel that they have a lot of choices in where the daycare is or where they're placed through the job programs. But other than that, I really think that there aren't any specific problems that are related to people that have children. I think it's very individual to each different household.
And the primary focus when someone's chronically homeless or just literally homeless is what kind of housing do you have? How quickly can I get in?
Thank you, guys. It was an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You got it? All right. Thank you.
Awesome program. You're up, Rebecca.
Okay, so we have our final quarterly report for the Community Fund CHG and ESG programs for services provided in 2015. So you now have a complete report. A couple of things that I wanted to mention to kind of keep in mind when you're looking at what the actual outcomes were versus the proposed outcomes is that 2015 was the first year where the Housing Solutions Center prioritized unsheltered and higher needs individuals and families for placement. And so what that did was it increased the cost of serving each household because we're dealing with many more barriers for each household. So it took longer time to work with the households and to work through those barriers. So that's some of the things that had changed and were brand new for 2015. And then also, some of the programs that didn't meet their outcomes, you'll notice were not funded for futures, for this year's funding round. So we know that the board really pays attention to those outcomes, and it's really important for the board to see a program with outcomes, and with the new funding, they kind of show the selection process. Most of the programs spent out their full grants or were very close to it. With the CHG funding on the very back, we had limitations on the funding that we could do, and so that we could spend. We had spending limits, and so we had to slow down programs and then speed them back up, so that caused issues with spending out some of the programs. We've talked several times about New Day Dental and the change in the Affordable Care Act, which caused them not to be able to spend out their grant. But the majority of the rest of the programs came very close. Those funds were recaptured and then reallocated out into the 2016 grants.
And one push that we really made is we received federal funds, Emergency Solutions Grant, which is on the very back on page 4, as well as state funds, Consolidated Homeless Grant. And when it comes to spending out, it's imperative that the agencies focus on the non-local funds first. We want to make sure that we're sharing the message to the state and to the feds that we need those dollars. And so there are a couple examples. SHARE is one where they put all their efforts into making sure that ESG and CHG were spent out. And so there might be a few locally funded programs that were not 100% spent out. It was because all their efforts went to trying to spend out CHG and ESG because of you know, different allocation methods and things. And so I wanted to make that point too. I can share, particularly with CHG, which ended at the end of 2015, that we spent out 99% of that funding, which was very exciting. I was just in a meeting yesterday, and some of the other large counties were around like 80 to 90% spending. So we did very well thanks to the agencies and their efforts.
So I'm confused.
Sure.
ESG share says they spent 55%.
That's a great question. And so their contract actually goes until the middle of 2016. And so they're still spending on that contract.
Oh, contract in June. Okay, sorry.
No, it's a
and
great
it's
question.
It's the only one that does that. So the ESG is the only funding source that has bridged over.
And then, so I guess the only one that came short would be the Salvation Army. I mean, family homelessness. That they went the furthest away, but it's a small number of dollars, so it didn't have a big impact.
Correct, yes. And then we were also... For some agencies like Salvation Army, where we were able to predict that they wouldn't spend out wholly, we were able to shift funds to a different agency so that they could spend it quickly. One agency, Council for the Homeless, they have a motel voucher program through Consolidated Homeless Grants. When we identified that Salvation Army wasn't going to spend out all their funds, we were able to move some of those dollars to the motel voucher program so that they could get spent. And of course, that can be spent in a very quick amount of time because it's just a night-to-night basis.
But that is not represented in the sheet,
right.
Correct?
It is. It's the third one down.
I see that.
It did. There were a number of kind of things that were moving around, and so it isn't represented in the sheet. You're correct.
Okay.
Well, the motel voucher originally is a $10,000 per year program. And so it is represented there.
So
they got bumped up to the 47,000.
Okay. But despite that, the Salvation Army program still came. So money went to the voucher program away from Salvation Army, but Salvation Army still came in under. Is that?
Or is Salvation Army not reflecting the change of moving the original funds?
That must be the case, because the contract, the money wouldn't have been taken from the contract without it being reduced. And so we can definitely take a closer look at that and be able to share up those numbers.
Thank you.
Yeah, because typically your budget amount is what's set at the beginning of the year, so share if the motel voucher program was originally 10,000 and we showed as budget amount 10,000, year to date 47, and that should pick up from the Salvation Army.
Yeah.
No, that's a good point.
Are there any other questions regarding the quarterly report? Any feedback on the report itself? We'll be looking at revamping the report for this year.
So I just am learning because I looked at the report and I was just kind of overwhelmed.
This report really shows and reflects how many programs the CAB oversees and where all of the funding goes to make sure that we have the biggest impact on the dollars that we do have.
Maybe that's a training we can do at some point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How to read the budget. Okay. Legislative update, please.
So I wanted to start by saying that we are in the middle of a Washington State legislative short session. It's basically just 60 days. It ends on Thursday, and so it's gone quickly. There was a Washington State Low-Income Housing Alliance Advocacy Day that happened in early February. And I know, Ty, you were there. Anything you'd like to share from that experience?
Lots of people. Great group of supporters from around the state. The thing about going to Olympia is it's a marketing campaign. Advocacy is a marketing campaign, and it's just rough thing. You say 8 touches to be successful. And when you get to Olympia in the middle of the session, that's got to be touch number 8. That can't be touch number 1. And so, especially in a short session like this, you know, we were hoping for things to happen. I think at the end of the day, the things we were hoping to be, the money that we were hoping was going to be made available to housing issues is not going to happen. The governor met with a group of housing advocates, primarily city advocates, last Friday. I know Alicia Topper from the Vancouver Council went up, and she walked away frustrated that the governor was not willing to even entertain the idea of declaring a housing emergency. Eight touches, and we just got to keep touching. So with that, the people who are participating in the advocacy group, just keep in mind you've got to be touching throughout the year with our local delegation, which, you know, all of the Clark County legislators and that's just a number, but you need to be. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. So it was a good day, good to show all that support. It's also one thing that happens in the short session. I'm talking a lot more, but I'm sorry. One thing that happens in the short session is model legislation starts to be put together for what will happen next year in the long session. Just because we didn't have something happen this year doesn't mean that a bill that got drafted this year won't continue to get refined and show up again next year. So paying attention to the kind of bills that happened this year. So the advocacy group again says, this last session, there was a bill that would have, and we would really like to see that happen again in the next session. Will you support it? Will you get behind it? And those are the kind of things that will help when the legislature is in session. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And Lydia was also there at the advocacy day. And I think I appreciate what you're sharing and that it sets up for the next legislative session. And one thing that was overwhelming, I think, during this particular legislative session is the interest in homelessness and trying to address homelessness and the fact that there are a number of communities in our state that have declared in a state of emergency around homelessness. And so as a result, there were a number of bills and efforts that have come forth to try to address it. And I know that time is very short, so I just want to mention a few highlights. One being that we are in the state legislative body, they're on track to pass the Truth in Evictions Reporting Act. And so right now, if someone has an eviction filed against them, that eviction is on their record regardless of the end result. And so even if there was no legitimacy to that eviction, it will still show up in the person's background check and then may affect their ability to rent in the future. And so this bill will mean that judges will have two separate filings, one where the eviction was found to be legitimate and it was cast against them versus another coding where the eviction actually wasn't filed against them and found to be legitimate. And so that makes a huge difference because people spend a lot of time having to prove to landlords that there was an eviction filed against them, but it was never found to be legitimate and the judge didn't rule against them.
Or even that you won.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a huge barrier for folks that seems very unnecessary. And then one other is a Fair Tenant Screening Act. And there has been this idea of portable screenings where people can go to an online background check agency. They pay $40 and then they receive a background check that has a number associated with it. And so then they can go to a landlord and say, if you go to, it's moco.com, which is the most common one. If you go to this moco.com website and you put in this password number, then you can see my background check online. And they should theoretically only have to pay an application fee once to that Moco website. And so it saves people, you know, potentially hundreds of dollars, because most people have to submit at least 3 application fees during their rental search. And so that, too, is a significant bill that is most likely going to pass this legislative session, and it will really affect tenants moving forward to help them be able to find housing. So that's significant. Another significant happening this legislative session is the opportunity for the Department of Commerce to allocate additional document recording fees that the state collects. Right now, they have approximately $7.5 million in the state coffers that Commerce is not authorized to allocate because they haven't received legislative authority. And so they're hoping during this legislative session they receive the authority and then can allocate those funds out to the different counties in the state. That will be significant because, as RJ mentioned, we saw an over 50% reduction in the state funding that we received for homelessness in the last allocation, so for the funding this year. And so if we receive additional funds, it'll give us an opportunity to kind of infill some of the cuts that existed utilizing the RFA that we did during the last year. So we're hoping that this forward motion continues and that these developments actually, you know, become reality. And there may be some pushes in the next 3 days where there could be advocacy opportunities. And of course, myself or Rebecca will send that out to you.
So let me add a local level.
Sure, thank you.
City of Vancouver, we are moving forward on, we're moving forward on a housing levy to go out to voters sometime either November or February of next year. Council of Homelessness is going to be leading up a campaign on that. In order to make that happen, we are going to be declaring a state of emergency. And with that, Councilmember Topper and I are putting pressure to really start pushing the boundaries of what that state of emergency will mean. We're frustrated that we haven't been able to secure land for a homeless village. We're continuing to push there. So please pay attention, show up to council. I think it's going to come to us the last meeting of the month, but I'm not, I don't know that it's been totally formed up yet.
So. Okay, I will be very, very, very fast. So let me talk slow. No, what I was going to do was, especially for new board members, explain what the National Community Action Foundation is and who David Bradley is, which is where we get most of our federal legislative information. And then do the current political environment, what the 2016 NCAP priorities are, the National Community Action Foundation priorities are, what the outlook is for 2017 appropriations, and where we are now. So instead, let me just very quickly tell you the main priority for 2016 for National Community Action Foundation, and they're the entity that kind of that shepherds through the federal appropriations process, the community services block grant funds that really drive the reason, the legislative reason for the advisory board to exist. So that is to continue to grow community services block grant funding for the network of community action agencies, increase funding for weatherization programs, which are traditionally have been a community action agency activity, protect the role at the federal level of community action agencies in weatherization, and probably most significantly, try to reauthorize community services block grant funds, which have not been reauthorized, have just been in continuing appropriations bills for the past 18 years. So for the first time in 18 years, David Bradley's big life goal, and I really think he will retire if, as soon as he gets this done, is to get a reauthorization. So the outlook, those are the priorities. appropriations in 2016 and going into 2017 is he actually thinks that the interests of the majority party in the Senate and the House are to have as a non-contentious appropriation process as possible, given the election years, given how the balances of power are within the Republican Party. We will see, but he's expecting that, that it will be relatively efficient when compared to previous years. So, where we are now, President's budget was released. It is dead on arrival. It does show that weatherization and community services block grant funds are flat funded, which was pretty disappointing. The House Budget Committee is working on their version of the budget. There are several Republicans that have stated that they're going to oppose any budget that does not include significant cuts in domestic spending. But really, House Republicans have four options. One is to, you know, there was a pretty significant budget agreement late last year, which pretty much set the funding levels for 2016 and 2017. So the four options on the table for House Republicans are, one, cut spending below what was agreed upon in their October 2015 budget agreement that Senator Murray and House Speaker Ryan were involved in. That would be pretty bad, not just because it would change what has been agreed on in the path ahead, but it would also probably automatically just lose all support from all the Democrats in the House and most of the moderate Republicans that remain. So that's one option. One is to increase defense spending and reduce other domestic discretionary spending. Third option is to produce a budget that follows the 2015 agreement. There isn't a clear path in that. And the last one is to not produce a budget at all and just have continuing appropriations. So those are the options ahead of them. Next week is the National Community Action Foundation Legislative Conference. So in future meetings, you know, there'll be a lot of information coming up in the next 3 weeks, you know, 2-3 weeks from now, coming out of that in terms of what's going on in the different House and Senate budget committees right now, what the odds of, you know, of appropriation bills actually passing, and what changes are being made to bills as they exist. So that's my update.
Awesome. That's great. Okay, well, we have open forum, but no public. Does anybody else have any discussion, anything?
This is fun stuff.
Yes. I missed it on the other business, but I'll get there.
Oh,
promise.
We're on other business.
All right.
Well,
so
before, I just wanted to quickly throw something out. Last Tuesday, at the Board of County Commissioners, some of you may have seen Lydia, myself, and Karen Dahidi of the Volunteer Lawyers Program.
Susan. Arne.
Susan Arne. Did I say your last name?
Sorry.
Oh, okay. Up before the County Council. And it went well. Susan did an amazing job of articulating what that program does and why the CAP funded. The reason Lydia was up there is if we had any questions regarding how did the program get funded, that she could articulate that there was an RFA, that there was a process, there's this advisory board that reviewed competing programs, that this was selected, you know, et cetera. And I wanted to tell this group, one, thank you, even though Lydia is not here, for taking the time to do that and represent it, and you know, represent the group and that process. But also let you know, don't be surprised, please, if it happens again. And that's not a reflection on the CAB, it's not a reflection on the programs, it's not a reflection on any budgetary process. Just, you know, what's pretty clear to me and to many of us right now is with the new charter in place and the transitions that come with that, and with new board members at the table, and with elections and contested elections coming out, board members are going to, you know, when the contracts, especially when contracts go up for signature, they may pull them out of a consent agenda and just to talk about them or to highlight, and that's okay. And you know, what we will always have is the answer of there was a legitimate process that was followed, and this is what the program does, and this is what the funding supports. You know, and let cards fall where they may after that. So, thank you to Lydia, even though she's not here, and just be ready. You know, that may happen again, and that's okay.
No. Other business?
Yeah.
Sweet. I have several things, and I'm so sorry that I don't have them on the agenda. First, I want to welcome Judith as our new board member. We are officially a full board. So, Judith, thank you so much for being able to make it to this meeting. She's going to go through orientation after we're done with our tour, so she'll get a whole lot of more information thrown at her today. Ty loves the idea of having electronic documents rather than hard copies, and so we're going to make sure that we email him the documents the night before the meeting, and I was just wondering if there's anyone else. I thought you might be, but I wanted to have a conversation. Okay, so...
My question, though, do we have... Because I always take this back and I put it in my binder.
Uh-huh.
So if we're doing electronically, we don't have to do that, right?
So we want to keep...
requirement?
So the... as long as the minutes reflect that we have provided the information to you, we are under compliance.
Yes.
So there are certain hard copies that we do need, like the conflict of interest,
and
things like that,
the
signed board, the signed minutes. Actually, those we have scanned also. But there are certain things that we would have you sign just so we can show compliance. But for the most part, as long as it's in the minutes that shows that we've given to you, we are good to go. So that won't be a problem. So what I'll do is just in practice is we'll just send out the entire meeting packet the night before to the entire board. We will still provide copies. I'll probably reduce the number that we bring. But we will have them here for those that prefer a hard copy. But please note that if we have a presenter, we may not have them to you, that you would have only a hard copy. What we will try to do is scan those documents and have them. Eventually, we do want to have the website up and running for the board that has all of the information on there, and then we can put all the documents from each meeting. So it would be more interactive for all of the board members. We would hope to get there. Don't expect it anytime in the next year. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that the Washington Low Income Housing Alliance annual homeless conference is May 11th and 12th in Spokane. And those of you that have been on the board for a while know that the CAB can pay for registration and travel to the conference. So if you're interested, please contact me as soon as possible once registration opens up. We want to get that in. We will need to figure out transportation accommodations. Typically, we take two board members with us to that conference for 2 days. So if you'll give me an email as soon as possible, let me know that you're interested. We can then move forward with getting all of the accommodations taken care of. But locally, we have coming up in April a community action symposium that is regions 8 and 10. It's being put on by the Oregon Community Action Foundation
Partnership.
And so this is the first time it's been local in the last several years. I provided an agenda of the topics that are going to be discussed. If you're interested in going, we can pay for your registration for that also. And I'll be going, so carpool if anybody would like to go. Please let me know also on this as soon as possible. Registration has been open, and early registration reduced fees is closing at the end of next week, I believe. So we want to get that registration done as soon as possible.
Is there a website for this?
There is. There is, and I can send you a link to it. And that is all I have. For those of you that are going on the tour of the building, Lifeline is graciously going to let us tour their day center and residential facilities. In order to do that, we have to sign a confidentiality agreement, which is this form right here, so if we can have that signed before we take off for the tour, that would be great, and we'll have it all ready to go. And that's the last thing I need.
Are you sure?
Besides the tour.
All right. So,
everybody going on the tour? What's the lifeline? We need to sign that. Want to just meet outside in 5 minutes, right outside the door?
Yes, and we have this room until 10, so if you wanted to leave your stuff here, you don't have to carry it with you.